I think shooting off your pack is the best thing going. I would rather shoot off my bag than bipod legs. I think a bag is that good to shoot off of.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. Straight to the point, no fluff, and no BS, this show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, please visit exomountaingear.com. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us on this episode. We are going back to a series that we did over the winter on the Building a Backcountry Rifle series, and we're getting more content related to that. So we have a guest returning from that series, Ryan Kleckner, who, if you've caught those episodes, you know how good this is. So this is actually our third episode with Ryan. To catch the first two, go back to that Building a Backcountry Rifle series. But in this third episode, Ryan returned to do us a favor, to do you a favor, and that is to answer your questions. So we actually recorded this one back in June, but we wanted to get to it now as rifle season is approaching quickly, is opening in some states, or maybe even if you're not getting out with a rifle this fall, maybe you're shopping for a new rifle over the new year, maybe for Christmas, maybe with a tax return. Maybe a new rifle is on the agenda for you. So in this episode with Ryan, we cover a bunch of things. Again, these are all your questions that you've submitted to us, but we talk about how to effectively shoot off of your pack in the field. We talk about what shooting positions a hunter should practice when dry firing, what distance you should zero your rifle for mountain hunting, what a hunter should look for in terms of barrel lengths, barrel profiles, and barrel weights for their rifle, the pros and cons and all those areas of barrel selection. We talk more about rifle selection, including, are the premium metal finishes and high-end stocks worth the increased cost for hunting rifle? We get into some nitty-gritty on the pros and cons for you tech geeks on the rifle side about push feed versus controlled round feed for bolt action rifles. And then we talk a bit about what a hunter should do when they're sighting in their rifle in conditions, maybe like over the summer, that they know will be different than what they will be hunting in. Like, how do you deal with that, knowing that your trajectory might change and that the rifle is going to behave differently from range scenario to in the field scenario? So we cover all that in this episode and more. Hope you guys enjoy it. It is a great one, and Ryan's information that he has to share is always incredibly helpful. But before we get into that, I want to thank you guys again really quick for listening to the podcast, for leaving reviews, and for leaving feedback. We always love to see that. If you guys could leave us a review in iTunes, that helps tremendously. If you want to contact us with questions, comments, or feedback, just shoot us an email to podcast@exomountaingear.com. We picked Mountain Man Sam, who left us an iTunes review, and we are sending Sam some Exo Mountain Gear and Hunt Backcountry swag for leaving that review. So again, if you leave a review or contact us, you are automatically entered into these giveaways. So Mountain Man Sam, please contact us with your shimmy information. We will get you set up. Speaking of swag, we have Hunt Backcountry swag coming soon. It's going to launch with episode 100 coming in a few weeks, and hopefully you've heard episode 100 is going to be huge. We have great giveaways for you guys, including an Exo Mountain Gear pack, but so much more. We're giving away at least $2,000 worth of gear. Haven't added it all up recently, but we have a bunch of our previous guests who have helped us out to give away all kinds of good stuff. So hunting gear, I mean, A to Z, all kinds of stuff. I can't even spill the details, but make sure you stay tuned. Episode 100 is going to be huge. Also, we just want to thank First Light. They've been helping us this year make this podcast a reality. As you know, if you've heard podcasts, Steve and I have been fans of First Light gear for years and years and years now. One thing I want to throw out at you guys, I think an overlooked piece of gear in the First Light lineup, especially for later season, as it's going to get cold, get snowy, get windy, and get nasty if you're out there, check out the North Branch pant. It's a soft shell pant, has an integrated gaiter, a very unique zipper system, a bib type suspender. It is an amazing piece of gear for late season hunts. And even I use it early season when it's still cold and you get into the spring, maybe on a turkey hunt or something like that, especially when it's wet. The soft shell fabric does wonders, especially if you're running and gunning on the ground, getting up, getting down, sitting and glassing. So check out the North Branch pant. I just don't see them mentioned a lot, but it's a piece that I've been using for, I think, 3 years now since they first released them, and absolutely a key piece for me as the weather turns nasty and cold. So check that out. Okay, let's get into this episode with Ryan Kleckner. Hope you guys enjoy. Ryan, welcome back for the third time. I think you're the first three-peat guest, so congratulations. You get the award. We'll be sending you a medal.
Outstanding. I got that going for me.
Add that to your resume, my friend.
Glad to be back, guys.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. We were just talking a bunch before getting into the show, and we're getting into so much good stuff. I had to put the stop on it and make sure that we hit record and capture all this. So we in this episode, we want to answer a bunch of your questions, listeners, that you have sent in after hearing part one and part two with Ryan and some of the other episodes in the Building a Backcountry Rifle series. You sent Steve and I some great questions, but Steve and I are not the authority, not the experts. We brought in Ryan to weigh in and get into that. But before we get into those listener questions, Steve, I know that you've been shooting a fair amount, and you know, as guys have heard the Building a Backcountry Rifle series, you're kind of newer to the rifle scene and have had a chance to not only get out and get the Weatherby sighted, but you know, getting ready to hopefully tag a bear with that. And we were just kind of chatting about shooting off of the Exo Mountain Gear pack frame, getting in position. Ryan, you're talking about slings. So Steve, kind of describe what you're going at. Ryan, you were in the midst of giving some good advice. So let's wrap that conversation back in and get it in the show.
Yeah, so we mentioned this on a couple podcasts ago, I think, where I went and I had a 5 mile bike ride into where I was bear hunting and just like, you know, rode in there 500 yards or something like that. And I brought a little shoot and see target with me, threw it on a box and set it right there. And then I kind of hit this road and went over, and it was 350 yards across to the target. And I just wanted to like verify that everything was shooting good. And on the road that I was on, I couldn't lay down. So I was standing my pack vertically trying to shoot off the top of it. And I was explaining to Ryan how I was having a tough time getting that stable. And then he started to chew my ass about not having a sling on it. So where do we go from there?
Continue the chewing, Ryan.
All right. So a sling is not a purse strap for a rifle. It's actually a tool that you use to shoot the rifle. Don't spend extra money on any other doodads or fancy gear until you at least have a sling on your rifle. The sling is useful not only, yeah, you could use it like a purse strap to carry your rifle when you're out walking around hunting, but it's also useful to wrap your arm up in, either in a full cuff style sling or in what I like to call a hasty sling. But it's also extremely useful when you're resting off of something. So backing up real quick, the hasty sling is most useful for hunting, and that's just my terminology for it, is you put your support arm all the way through the sling so it's high up on your tricep, above or where your tricep should be if you have one, high up on the back of your arm. And then you wrap your arm around the sling once so your palm is back to the fore end of the stock of the rifle pinched between the sling. And you should be adjusting your sling at home so it's just tight enough that when you wrap your arm around the sling like that, it provides you enough tension that it can actually hold the rifle. You can take your firing hand off the rifle and it should hold just fine. That adds a lot of stability to shooting platforms. And the reason you have the sling to do that, and the reason we're even going to talk about shooting off of a pack, is because in the real world, you don't find shooting benches in the wild. You try to get in the prone, you're going to be staring into grass or a rock. You're not going to see. But when we go to the range to get ready for the hunt, all of us shoot off of a shooting bench, or we lay down on the prone to zero our rifles, and we shoot a pretty little group, and we pat ourselves in the back, and then we go hunting. And if we're honest with ourselves, we never shoot from the prone when we're hunting. It's always from the side of a tree, from your pack, from a knee, from standing, from something like that. So why guys aren't practicing that, I don't know. So the first thing is I encourage everyone, when you're at the range shooting, pick your acceptable kill zone. I think we talked about that last time. Whatever you define as an acceptable size, you know, go put a pie plate out at 300 yards. Put a pie plate at 200 yards, let's say, because you guys might be learning this. And see if you can hit it. Stand up, pick up the rifle, and try and hit a pie plate.
Yeah.
That is going to be way better practice for hunting than shooting a pretty little group and then not being able to hit the pie plate at all. If you really want to press yourself, do 20 jumping jacks first and then try and hit it, because that's going to be more realistic training for hunting. You know, when people miss when they're hunting, it's not often the equipment. It's not that your rifle wasn't accurate enough. You know, guys will spend so much time and energy getting the best, the most accurate, the flattest shooting, all these great things. But they don't miss because the rifle wasn't good enough. They miss because they have bad marksmanship, or they have unstable position or poor trigger control. So instead of doing that, I would rather take an off-the-shelf Cabela's rifle and go practice and learn to shoot, and I'd be way more successful hunting than having a top-of-the-line rifle that can shoot these pretty little groups, but I have no idea how to shoot while I'm standing. Does that make sense?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So when you're resting on things, the problem is, one, you have to get up higher off the ground when you're in the real world. And the problem with that is, the higher you get, the less stable you are. So the prone on the ground is the most stable, and then standing is the least stable. So it's just gradually, as you get higher and higher, you get less and less stable. So you want to rest your rifle on something. So you use your pack, which is great. So many people forget their pack is there. And I think shooting off your pack is the best thing going. I would rather shoot off my bag than bipod legs. I think a bag is that good to shoot off of. But when you get high up off the ground, the problem is the front of your rifle, let's say your pack was perfectly stable. I'm assuming it may have moved a little bit, but let's replace your pack with the tripod for a second, okay, to take some variables out of it. So the front of your rifle is resting on a tripod. That means the front of your rifle is now perfectly stable, but you aren't. So as you breathe and as your body moves, the entire back of the rifle is now going up and down and side to side with you. So that's a problem. The rifle is now acting like a seesaw or teeter-totter on whatever you're resting the rifle on. So what I like to do with a sling when I'm shooting off of a pack, a tripod, even a branch or something that I'm resting the rifle on, is I take my support hand and I push down into the sling. So I have some pictures. Maybe I'll try and dig some up demonstrating this. But if you can picture laying the rifle on your pack, you were sitting, Steve?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just take – are you right-handed?
Yep.
All right. Just – yeah. So as you're in that seated position, you have the rifle on the bag. Take your left hand and find the center of the sling, which is probably right at the bag or right in the middle, and just push down from either resting the full weight of your arm or actually pushing down hard on the rifle will immediately stabilize the rifle, because what it does is it pulls down on the rifle equally on the front and the back. So you had a pivot point, and now when you push down on the sling in the center, it automatically pulls the front and the back of the rifle at the same time, and it takes all the wobble out, makes it really stable.
Huh. Yeah, I was definitely I kept like trying to figure out what the best balance point was there. Was I get the pack way out towards, you know, the end of the barrel, or back towards like right past the, right before the trigger?
I like putting it right before the trigger. I put it right in the middle, tuck it in close. Because again, the further out you get, you think you're getting more stable, right? The further away it is, you think it's getting more stable. But all you're doing now is taking your body, which is the least stable part, and making it as far as possible away from the stable thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I would hug a pack. Get up on a knee if you need to. So also when you're shooting from a knee, most of us will put, I'm right-handed, so my left knee normally goes forward. If I'm just walking and I need to take a knee to take a shot, I put my left knee out front and I rest my left elbow on my left knee. That's how we all take a kneeling shot.
Mm-hmm.
When you're resting off of something, you should switch your knees, because you don't need that front knee anymore. You're not needing that knee for the stability for your arm. Instead, you're using a pack or a branch or a tripod. Instead, now the part that's moving is your body. So I have my right knee up. I switch my knees completely, rest my right elbow on my right knee. So now the back of the rifle can be stable and supported and isn't moving all around. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Be great to have a picture for a visual for everybody.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll try and fish something up for you.
Perfect.
Maybe the next magazine coming out from Recoil might have an article for me on this exact topic with pictures. But I don't think I can say for sure.
Hint, hint, maybe. Might be worth checking out. So we actually had a question on this topic of positioning in practice, Ryan. One of the listeners who heard you talking about, you know, the dry fire routine and putting all that together was wondering specifically what positions they should be practicing in terms of dry fire. You know, should it only be prone, or should they try and pull off some of these more field positions with their dry fire practice? What are your thoughts on that?
Field positions only, once you get good at it. So yeah. The whole reason you're dry firing is you're trying to see how much you're moving and you're affecting the rifle. When you're in the prone and you're super stable, you shouldn't be affecting the rifle. That's almost like cheating. So dry fire in the prone, you're getting used to it. But once you've mastered that, you've got to get into different positions. You know, I'm not impressed when someone can shoot a perfect little group from the prone. That's just what you're supposed to be able to do. Try and do it from the kneeling, seated, standing position gets pretty difficult. So that's what I'd be practicing.
Okay, cool. So prone's just the foundation, the baby step to getting to where it really matters.
Well, yeah. I mean, you guys are bow hunters, but have you ever shot a rifle from the prone when you're out hunting and it wasn't prairie dog hunting?
No.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. So why practice that?
Yeah. Awesome. Let's dive into another listener question right away. Charlie wrote in wondering about a good distance to zero a rifle for mountain hunting, choosing a standard distance such as 200 and then kind of compensating or following you know, other recommendations. For example, if a certain ammunition manufacturer has a recommendation or there's just certain schools of thought about certain calibers being sighted at certain distances. What are your thoughts on zeroing in a rifle for hunting, say for, you know, somebody who's not going extreme long range, but just kind of a general, you know, say 100 to 500 yard effective range? What distance should they zero?
Good question. So first off, your listeners are very involved and ask good questions. So I was just mentioning to you guys, I had an onslaught of questions. I loved them. I answered them all. But you guys were actually critically thinking and paying attention to what we're talking about. It was great hearing these good questions come in. Unfortunately, my answer to this one is it depends. I wish I had a clear nugget for you to run with, but I don't. What he's really asking is he's talking about, I think, maximum point blank range. Have you guys ever heard that term before?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's the theory that the path of a bullet for a particular caliber or cartridge can stay within the acceptable kill zone without aiming high or low. Right. So, for example, I always use the 308 because it's the NATO cartridge, the military cartridge. If you zeroed it at 200 yards, or I zero all my rifles at 100 yards always, and if I want it to hit at 200, I adjust up to 200 of my scope. But I'll just call that zeroing. So if I came up on my scope 2 minutes of angle so that I was dead on at 200, I know that if I shot at 100 yards, I'm going to be 2 inches high. So that's acceptable. I shoot at 200 yards, I'm going to be dead on. At 300 yards, I'll be 9 inches low. We can do the math, but it might be hard to follow on a podcast. You know, because normally at 300 yards, my 308 needs to come up 5 minutes of angle. And if you guys remember, a minute of angle is about an inch per 100 yards. So that means it needs to come up 15 inches at 300 yards, that 5 minutes of angle. Well, if I already dialed in the 2 minutes up for 200, that means I'm still missing 3 minutes of angle at 300 yards. I need to come up more, which is the 9 inches.
Right.
So if I had a target where that was acceptable, a 9-inch low hit, sure, I'd zero at 200 or put the scope on 200 yards. And then anything between me and 300, I could shoot at it, just aiming exactly where I want to aim. And the worst I'd be would be 9 inches low at 300. The problem is some people do the math backwards. So, for example, that same 308 needs 12 minutes at 500 yards. And I'll hear some guys say, oh, so what I'll do is I'll just dial up for 500 yards. And that 12 minutes that you adjusted up means you're going to hit 12 inches high at 100 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, oh, I'm only a foot high. You know, so I'm talking like a military context or a giant kill zone context. Now I'm only 12 inches high at worst when I'm really close. And then it's going to drop all the way down into 500. Well, no, that's not true. The bullet isn't traveling only 12 inches high and then dropping all the way back down. It's traveling much higher than that. So the problem is each adjustment that you make for a certain distance isn't a laser adjustment you're making to the actual bullet's path. The bullet is still traveling like a basketball and dropping into the target.
Right. It's arcing, more so not firing elements. A straight line.
Right.
Right.
So when it goes through the paper at 100 yards, 12 inches high, it's not dropping right away from there. It's still traveling further away from the ground. So, for example, I just told you at 200 yards, I would come up 2 minutes. Well, if I had 12 minutes dialed in, that means I'd be 10 minutes too high at 200 yards. 10 minutes at 200 yards is 20 inches. So I'd be 12 inches high at 100, 20 inches high at 200, 21 inches high at 300, and then it would start dropping back down. So be careful with the math there. Don't just look at the furthest distance and then see the problem at 100. So for most hunting purposes, if someone just wanted a straight answer, yeah, 200. Zero at 200 yards. That way you'd be a little high at 100. You'd be a little low at 250. That's a great hunting distance. Now, if you want to get like out to 500 with one adjustment on your scope, it's going to be pretty tough. I mean, even if you're shooting with a flat shooting bullet, it's going to be hard to have a kill zone that big on an animal. So the military does that. I mean, there's an old Russian military manual that talks about just keeping the scope zeroed for 500 yards and aiming at the belt buckle of the bad guy. Because then no matter what, between zero and 500 yards, it's going to hit them between the belt buckle and the head because there's enough room there. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about hunting.
Right.
So your 30 caliber magnums, I would almost always go out with a 200 yard zero.
Yeah. I ended up doing a 200 on my 270 because it's, inch and a half high at one and 6.5 at 300 low. So it wasn't, figured that was acceptable. And that way, if I'm going through the woods and it's thick and something's there at 250 yards, I just don't have to think about it and I can shoot.
Right. Or you can just fudge a little high. You don't have to worry about it that much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly right.
Yeah, there's certainly a huge mental advantage, if nothing else, in a hunting situation of not having to worry about doing math or compensating if you don't have to. I mean, clearly when you get into the longer ranges, you need to do that for accuracy, but you also have the time to do that. And if you don't have the time, you shouldn't be taking a long shot. But yeah, for that kind of within point blank to 300 yards, it's a huge asset, I believe, to be able to just, hold center really for the most part and be confident.
Well, and know what the animal looks like, an average animal that size in your scope. So even if you have a duplex scope, at least take one time to go look at a target that tall at that distance and see how high it is up to the duplex reticle. Because when you're shooting in the mountains, you're shooting from one ridge to the next and you can't see the ground between the two of you because it goes down too far and then comes back up again. It's easy, especially in the adrenaline of the hunt, to be off by more than 100 yards. Hmm. You're looking through a magnified scope at the animal, you could easily mistake 300 or 400 yards when you're not paying attention and if you can't see the ground. So that's called a non-visible depression. So whenever the ground goes down, it's called a depression. And if it's not visible the entire way, things always appear much closer because your brain can't make up for all that terrain all the way to the target. And conversely, if it is a visible depression, if you can see the ground all the way down and all the way back up to the target, people think the target's always further than it really is because they see all that terrain down and up instead of the straight line distance.
Yeah.
We even used to, when I was teaching sniper students, as a absolutely stupid sniper joke, as we'd repaint the steel targets, every once in a while the other instructor and I would put a frowny face on one of the targets and we're asking the students to range estimate it. Or they'd give us a number. We're like, well, no, hold on. Frowny face, visible depression. Remember, it's going to appear closer.
Yeah, that's pretty bad, but I like it. Okay, we had several questions, kind of different topics related to somewhat rifle selection. So let's kind of lump these together. First and foremost, let's talk a little bit about barrel lengths and barrel profiles for a hunting rifle. Clearly, you got guys who are in the camp of wanting to save weight and shave ounces as much as possible. So you could go with a thinner profile barrel, a shorter profile barrel. However, there clearly could be some disadvantages at some extent to, decrease in not only length, but really getting a thin profile barrel as it relates to accuracy or heat issues, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. What would you recommend looking for, again, obviously in the context of a hunting rifle, in terms of barrel lengths and profiles? Is there a good middle ground? Is it just a matter of avoiding extremes? Kind of talk us through the thought process there.
Okay. You mentioned barrel length. And you also mentioned accuracy, so I want to hit on that first.
Well, yeah, I mean, length is, I guess,
yeah, just one of the variables.
Obviously affects velocity more than accuracy, but yeah.
Correct. Matter of fact, it affects accuracy inversely. Shorter barrels are more accurate than longer barrels. So...
Sorry, I don't want to interrupt you, maybe get in here, but I just had the thought. Is that because there's less time for the barrel to influence the bullet in terms of, like, if you make... any sort of movement or don't follow through correctly? Would that be a reason why?
Maybe.
Okay.
I'll give you an honest maybe. I don't think so. No, even for people talk about recoil management, you know, yeah. I say all these great shows we have on TV now, we can see the super slow motion of the bullets leaving the rifle.
Yeah.
I ask them to go back and watch one of those again and tell me if they've ever seen the barrel even slightly move before the bullet was completely out of the gun.
Yeah, it happens so fast.
People are always like, oh, no, yeah, every time you see it in super slow motion, you see the barrel, the bullet completely leave. Then you can skip a couple beats, and then you see the rifle start to recoil. So, no, I don't think you're going to... Yes, you need to have good follow-through. Yes, you need to have good platform. I'm not trying to say it's not important, but no, it's not that. So stiffer barrels are more accurate than thinner barrels or weaker barrels or whippier barrels. Okay, that's just a maxim we can talk about. So consistency is the key to accuracy. So the more you can do the same, the more accurate you're going to be. So a stiffer barrel is more consistent because it doesn't flex. And as long as it's super rigid and stiff and it doesn't flex, it's going to be more accurate than the thinner barrel. That's why. Just purely consistency. Well, that barrel is whipping and flexing and vibrating and doing an awful lot as that bullet is traveling down the barrel. The longer the barrel is, the more it whips and the more it flexes. So just imagine taking a stick of a certain diameter that's long enough that you could easily break it with both your hands. Break it. And then take one of the halves that's remaining and try and break the half. It's going to be a lot harder to break than the original stick was. It's the same diameter, same stick, but because it's shorter, you don't have as much leverage, so it's harder to bend it. And it seems like it's a stiffer stick. Same thing happens with the barrel. So I shoot an 18-inch barreled 308. That's what my target gun is. People laugh when they see it at the range. Looks like the rest of my barrel fell off the gun. I mean, it barely sticks out past the stock. But that barrel is completely rigid and completely stiff and does not flex near as much as a longer barrel. So it gets more accurate. We've actually chopped off many students' barrels in the course with a Sawzall, if you'll believe it. We've had got students out there that didn't believe it, that were brave enough to let us do it. We put masking tape, take a measuring tape out, put masking tape where you want to cut it, take a Sawzall and cut the barrel, then use a hand crowning tool that you can buy on Brownells. And put it in there and by hand crank with some cutting oil and put a new crown on the barrel, even with the rough saw teeth on the rest of the barrel except for the crown, and have them shoot another group, and the groups every single time immediately tighten up when you lop the barrel off. So it's not an accuracy issue for barrel length. It's a velocity issue. You're not going to have the same velocity. It's going to be a lot slower than it was when it was longer. Not a lot, but it's going to be slower. So when you're hunting and you want to transfer as much energy as you can to the target to make an ethical kill, that's the problem with a shorter barrel, is just pure velocity. So I like a shorter barrel not only because it's more accurate, but it's easier to carry around. So I can get a relatively stiffer, thicker target-style profile barrel in a rifle that still doesn't weigh as much overall because the barrel's short, versus getting a longer, thinner barrel that's going to flex and whip around a much more. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Why is the bullet slower? I can't wrap my head around that one.
Because so rifle powder burns slow, pistol and shotgun powders burn fast. Okay, matter of fact, pistol and shotgun gunpowders are the same powder. Okay, so most pistol loads for reloaders, they use shotgun powder or vice versa. So all the energy of that powder is intended to be burned up within about 6 inches, and it's done. Guys that blow up their guns reloading, almost always it's because they forgot which powder jug they were using, and they put handgun powder in a rifle. And it's therefore that huge stack of powder all got ignited and used within 6 inches, which was too much energy. Rifle powder burns slow. So magnum rifle powders burn really slow. The idea is the burn rate is retarded enough that it's slowly picking up velocity and energy all the way to the very end of the barrel till it finally pops out the end of the barrel. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So you chop that barrel off, you get that fireball out of the end of the gun. That's wasted energy that bullet was supposed to be getting as it was speeding up down the barrel.
Yeah.
Interesting. So why not create a faster burning powder?
You can, which is why some cartridges are more conducive to shorter barrels than others.
Oh, okay.
But your magnum cartridges almost always need longer barrels. That's because you have this giant case capacity with all this powder in there. And if you torched off all that powder and it burned too quick, you're going to blow the gun up. The pressure will be way more than a rifle can handle. So to make use of it, so what they do is they take these giant cartridges, as you get these bigger and bigger calibers, and those giant cartridges only perform when all that powder that you stuffed in there, that's the reason you got so big of a case, is to be able to use all that powder. Well, the only way you could safely use all that powder is to give the bullet long enough of a runway to get that powder to burn. Yeah. Which for reloaders, that's why if I like reloading or hand loading, mm-hmm. ball powder seems like it'd be the best shape. You know, just little spherical balls because it meters well in devices. You know, it goes through the measuring device well. But it's the worst powder for accuracy because they're little balls that are burning. And as they burn, they actually put chemicals on them to make them burn slower. But as that ball burns, it gets smaller and smaller, so there's less surface area, so that burns inconsistent. That's why when you look at the target rounds, you look at target gunpowder, it's usually little sticks or flat flakes or things like that, just as a little extra FYI, because it all has to do with how consistently you can burn as the bullet goes down the barrel.
Okay. Very cool.
So related to that as well, Ryan, would be different barrel profiles, and this is obviously... you know, there's some differences there in what's offered kind of on several hunting rifles. So if we look at, for a hunting situation, you know, you kind of mentioned you want to keep velocity. So you look at a longer barrel, and then so some rifles will then make a thinner contour barrel on that longer length to then reduce weight. Some of the common disadvantages that are kind of touted there is, you know, there's thinner material, it can heat up quicker. If you're shooting multiple shots, the barrel gets heated, you know, accuracy could decrease. That makes sense, and that can kind of be...
Yeah, that's not going to happen while you're hunting, though.
I mean,
unless you're prairie dog hunting.
I was going to say...
The barrel's going to heat up after your fifth round.
Right. I was going to say that could be reproduced on the range easily if you're doing firing quickly, but in a hunting scenario, do you see really any downside to going with maybe a thinner profile, something that's fluided?
Sure. It is less accurate, and if it's a big enough cartridge, it's going to knock your teeth out. You know, lighter guns are really cool to carry, but they're not exactly fun to shoot.
Right.
Right? So recoil is definitely a function of the weight of the gun. For a hunting rifle, an ideal hunting rifle to me would be so light that it'd be a novelty. So ideal hunting rifle to me is one of those rifles you can pull out of your safe and hand it to your buddy, and the first comment out of their mouth is like, oh, that's so light, that's so amazing. That's a cool hunting rifle to me. Because I don't know about you guys, but I'm humping that thing 99% of the time or more than I'm shooting it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'd rather it be more comfortable while I'm carrying it. And it's not going to knock my teeth out when I'm shooting at the animal because I'm going to be thinking so much about the shot I'm not even going to notice the recoil.
Yeah.
So yes, you'll have less accuracy with a thinner barrel. There's no free lunch. It's personal preference. You want a super accurate rifle, then build yourself a sniper rifle and carry it. I mean, it's heavy, but it's going to be ridiculously accurate. Just stop getting in the mindset of shooting pretty groups. Because if you get the sporter thin profile barrels, and you try and go shoot groups at distance at the range, you're going to be disappointed. That's not what that gun is for.
Yeah.
That gun is to shoot decent enough accuracy to go hunting. You want a target gun, go get a target gun. You know, a Toyota Prius is not going to haul lumber. Get a pickup truck. no free lunch. Just pick which one you want. But for me, again, for hunting, I would rather enjoy the hunt while I'm out there. I'd rather enjoy walking around and glassing. You know, and if I have to shoot with a lightweight gun that may not be as perfectly accurate as it needs to be, I'm not shooting target ammo either. I'm not going to shoot match-grade ammo when I'm not shooting. I'm shooting hunting ammo, which isn't going to be perfect anyway. But modern rifles with quality ammunition should be able to hit a minute of angle, maybe a minute and a half.
Yeah.
You know, so a 6 or 7 inch group at 300, which of us would not be happy on whatever hunt we're on hitting a 6 inch target at 300 yards?
Right.
That's two minutes. So when people miss, it's not about the rifle, but it's amazing how much time people will spend and energy people will spend money, which is, I guess, time and energy, on the most expensive rifle, the most quality, this and that. But they won't spend time on the Stairmaster getting ready to hike up and down the mountain. Or when they miss, they'll blame it on the rifle.
Yeah.
No. I mean, again, a two-minute rifle, none of us would be happy if we went to the range and bought this awesome new rifle and got it all set up and all we could shoot was 2 minutes out of it. We would all be disappointed. But honestly, when you're hunting, 2 minutes would be awesome. That's all you need. When you miss when you're hunting, it's not because your rifle wasn't accurate enough. It's because you were unstable or you jerked the trigger or you misjudged the distance. It's always something like that. It's never coming home from hunt saying, man, I need to upgrade to a more accurate rifle if I'm going to be successful next time.
Yeah.
along those same lines, how does the weight of a rifle correlate to accuracy? So with a bow, you know, we talk about we add weights and stuff like that, and a heavier bow is more stable. But with a rifle, as I was going through the shooting process, I mean, most of the time it's rested on something that's bearing that weight. And I just don't, I mean, I can understand if you're just standing and shooting, but I would think resting on something, the weight kind of, you know, has much less of an effect.
Maybe. Yeah, it has less of an effect than a bow, probably, but it still matters. So the weight of a rifle does not affect its accuracy. It affects your accuracy, right? Okay. So the rifle's going to be just as capable to do what it does on its own if you bolted it into a vise. But you get a gun too light, it can be hard to shoot. I'm a big fan of shooting 22s for training, for practice. I'll get a little bolt-action 22 rifle and go practice. It's fun. It'll get you better at shooting. But if you get too light of a 22, it's almost impossible to shoot because every little breath and bump makes the rifle jump all over the place. So target shooters will do the same thing with rifles and even handguns. They'll add weights to them sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But again, 2 minutes. That normally is... That's not a target you would take a picture of and share on Instagram with your friends because you shot a pretty group. 2 minutes is usually the worst group you shot for the day. Heck, right. Let's even call it 3 minutes. A three-minute group is the worst group of the day. That's still 9 inches at 300 yards. That means you could hit the nine-inch circle, which that's a kill zone, depending on the animal. 300 yards away, that's a perfect hunt.
Yeah. Yeah, it... In many ways, it's futile, right? Because so many guys still tend to, you know, especially if you get on forums and things like that, they're still trying to, like, push the limits of these lightweight hunting rifles and measure distances between, you know, 3/4 MOA and 0.8 and, you know, talking about differences at that point. But in the end, as you kind of mentioned, take it and practice shooting at the field, get off the bench, get off of shooting tiny groups if you're using a hunting rifle. That's not even what it's for. And really just
shoot tiny groups to zero your scope and then don't do it again or to confirm zero. That's it.
Yeah.
You're never going to do that in the field. You're never going to shoot groups. And if you do have to shoot an animal twice, shooting them in the same spot twice is kind of stupid.
So, didn't work the first time. Yeah.
Yeah. I see guys at the range, like tactical training guys, will draw with a pistol and like double tap a target really fast. Be like, look at that. The two holes are touching. Like, congratulations. You just shot the target where it was already shot. Probably be better to shoot them 10 inches away.
That's funny. Yeah. I'm curious, Ryan, this is off topic, but as we were talking about, you know, even you would prefer a lightweight rifle for hunting. On the opposite end of that, and if you look at accuracy and you kind of talk about one of your sniper long range setups, what kind of weight is the total package for you with glass and everything?
Well, the heaviest rifle I used to have to carry was the Barrett 50 cal.
Well, yeah, that's an extreme example. Yeah.
Well, it's 37 pounds.
Yeah.
That gets heavy. So we actually used to put a thick machine gun sling on it because it was like a big, thick guitar strap.
Mm-hmm.
Just carry that on a sling. I don't know. I think if like you can get a
700
rifle,
platforms, it's... though, once it's...
I honestly don't remember. Yeah. I wish I could. I don't have a scale I put my rifles on.
Right.
I'm sorry. To me, a lightweight hunting rifle, 6 pounds is screaming light to me as a complete rifle.
Yeah.
Mm. You can get less than that, but I don't know if I'd want to shoot it.
Right.
Anything less than 10 pounds, I think, is acceptable.
Yeah.
I forget who did it. I wish I could remember the name right now. I shouldn't bring it up, but I'm going to do it anyway. Somebody, maybe it was Jeff Cooper, talked about a test to grab your rifle and hold it, your arm straight out. And I think he said a minute. If you can hold it for a minute, it's the right weight for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, people are amazed at how hard that is to do sometimes with the rifle. But yeah, just get a 10-pound rifle. Spend way more time practicing, learning how to shoot than you do on the fanciest, sexiest rifle, the coolest glass, the coolest rangefinder, all that. Because again, when you miss when you're shooting, it's not because your rifle isn't expensive enough.
Right.
There's not a single person out there that I couldn't give a rifle from Cabela's to, let's say within 300 yards, that they wouldn't have had the same miss with, or I can give an expensive rifle and they're still going to miss with it because it was their fundamentals or their platform or something like that. So the other thing for weight, I'm guilty of this too, so I'm not pointing fingers here. Don't go work a whole bunch of overtime hours to save up a bunch of money to get a rifle that weighs 2 pounds less. Go for a couple jogs and make yourself weigh 2 pounds less. It's a lot easier.
The right? Cost per ounce, yeah.
Yeah, right? So don't panic about it. Get, you know, beware of the man with one rifle, right? Get a You get a decent quality, accurate enough rifle that's going to be reliable for you in the field, and go shoot the snot out of it and get good with it. And don't go overboard on any direction. You know, everything in moderation, including moderation, right? So don't get the biggest, most powerful caliber. You know, 300 rum is not the biggest, most powerful caliber, but it's punishing. I know guys that get it, like, oh, I got this rifle. Yeah, check it out. It's 300 rum. Why? What is that for? For hunting. For hunting what? Well, I might go bear hunting someday. Okay, you might. But you're a deer hunter.
Right.
There's actually a problem with shooting too big of a cartridge like that. You know, the whole idea of the bullet is to deform and try to stop or cause as much damage as it can to a target. There's plenty of times people take something like a 300 rum and shoot a deer with it, and the deer takes off running. They get a perfect hit, and the deer takes off and runs away. Because the bullet goes in one side, goes out the other side. It's a perfect skinny little hole. You might as well shot it with a field point arrow. Because the bullet doesn't even have a chance to expand. So you can definitely overgun yourself. You can definitely get, you know, too light to where it's too hard to shoot. So get below 10 pounds. Get a caliber. Here's my advice. If you're picking a caliber for a new gun, if you're like me, I'll daydream about it for months on which caliber I want to get for the next gun. Get whatever caliber you can get at the local sporting goods store wherever you went hunting. You know, I don't like 300 Win Mag. I kind of, for some reason, I hate that cartridge. But
you just made a lot of people mad.
Well, that's what I'm going to pick. So my hunting rifle I'm building right now, 300 Win Mag. I don't like belted magnums. I think they're useless. I think it's crazy to headspace off of the back of a cartridge. But I know I can get 300 Win Mag anywhere. Yeah. I could stop at a gas station in Alaska and probably find a box of 300 Win Mag. So that's why I'm doing it. Yeah. I like 28 nozzle or 30 nozzle are way better, but I'm not going to find those anywhere.
Yeah, for sure.
So I'm not going to go crazy. That's why the whole moderation thing. I'm not going to go too exotic on the caliber, too exotic here and there, because when I show up on the hunting trip and I realize I forgot to pack my ammo, or the TSA took it, or I lost it or something, there I go. 300 Win Mag. I can find it at the local store and shoot it, and it'll be just fine.
Awesome. So we had Jordan kind of wrote in about a few different topics, but really to boil it down to kind of wanting to get some input on, you know, some of the more modern hunting rifles that have, you know, stainless barrels and synthetic stocks, more of the weather type series rifles versus the old traditional blued barrels and wood stocks. He kind of commented that to him some of the synthetics felt flimsy, crappy, got slippery when wet, and kind of wondered if the stainless and those things really provided advantages, considering how long guys have been getting it done with the blued barrels. What are your kind of thoughts on there in terms of the steels, the finishes, exposing those types of things to the weather for a hunting rifle?
Good question. Don't rely on the fact that guys have been getting it done for a long time, though. I mean, that was the argument against scopes when they first came out. You know, people didn't want to adopt scopes or Gore-Tex. Guys got it done for a long time without Gore-Tex, but I'm not going to. I'm going to bring some. Depends on the rifle. Your entry-level, I don't want to call them budget rifles because they're amazing rifles, but entry-level rifles that are trying to hit a certain price point are cutting costs. And unfortunately, that's where most manufacturers are going. It's sad to see it happening to the firearms industry, but they start cutting costs. And the easy places to cut costs, the easiest on bolt action rifles, are the finish and the stock. Because I can take whatever rifle any company has, and if I was tasked with making it cheaper, I can't change anything else without actually redesigning and re-engineering and remaking the gun. But I'm sure I could find somebody that could make a plastic hollow stock for 50 cents cheaper. And I'm sure I can find somebody that, instead of coating it the way it should have been coated and prepped the metal the way it should have been prepped, I can find a way to skip a couple steps and get it done cheaper. So that's the problem, is you have these rifles that are blued or they're Parkerized or whatever coating, but it's not all the same. I mean, I have some rifles that I think are great rifles. They're great value. I have as kind of truck extra guns, but if you look at them crooked, they'll rust. So that's not a good thing. You know, rust not only makes the gun ugly, it can actually degrade the accuracy and hurt the gun. So having a light coat of oil on the gun at all times is a really good idea, but that's not fun to worry about in the field, how oiled your gun is on the outside. So stainless has a lot of merits to it, but stainless isn't stain proof. And so stainless still will corrode when it's in bad enough conditions. A good thing about stainless is the barrel's harder. Stainless steel is harder than carbon steel, so the barrels last longer. So if you're worried about shooting out a barrel, you know, so you get like the 300 Win Mag, it's not going to last 10,000 rounds like a 308 will. But you get it in stainless, you're going to get an extra 10 or 15% more rounds out of it for barrel life just because the stainless is harder, so it's going to last longer. That's kind of nice. The synthetic stocks that come on some of the rifles, I think, are junk. I think they should be thrown away. I mean, I recommend quite a few, what I keep calling the Cabela's rifles, for people to start out with. But I'll tell them the first thing they should do when they get home is yank the stock off and throw it away and go buy a $200 stock as an upgrade and put it on. One of the saddest things, I think, with some of the hollow plastic stocks are they're just not fun to shoot. And I think guns should be enjoyable to shoot. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what it is, but something about a wood stock and the recoil management or something about the connection of you to the gun with a wood stock just feels great. Not always practical. I get it. So if you're going to go synthetic, I recommend upgrading and getting either a solid synthetic stock or a stock with a full-length aluminum bedding block in it. I mean, I don't like glass bedding my rifles anyway with fiberglass. And that's the Target uber cool way to get the action into the stock to be a perfect glove fit. But that stuff is eventually going to crack. It's going to maybe change or expand with temperature changes out there in the wild. That's a Target gun to me. So a decent synthetic stock with aluminum bedding blocks in it so I can take the action out and clean out the dirt and pine needles that got between the barrel and the stock when I tripped and fell. That's a benefit to me.
Yeah.
Stainless steel, sure, do it. Don't break the bank on it if you can't afford it, or if you have a blued gun, you know, don't avoid it. Just keep the gun oiled. Especially if you live in a humid environment, you can go ahead and, you know, put some light solvent in the barrel when you put it away in the safe. But does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. I'd like to back up or kind of pause on the bedding issue, just because, you know, a lot of guys hear that, but I don't think some guys fully understand that. I know that I didn't until this recent rifle project when I really dove into understanding, you know, what is an aluminum bedding, what's a bedding block, what's glass bedding, and all that, and went with the aluminum bedding myself. But go ahead and kind of key us in on what does that really mean, what is the bedding process, what are the advantages to the aluminum bedding, for example.
Okay, so going back to the consistency is the key to accuracy. You want a consistent fit between the action and the stock. And the reason is you control the gun with the stock. So if you are holding the stock and that's what you're moving and holding stable, but the receiver and the barrel are inconsistently mounted or loose in the stock, you're going to have a problem that when you shoot, it's going to move within the stock and not be stable. So you want the best possible mating surface you can get between that receiver and the stock. When you have cheaper synthetic stocks, you're not going to get that. It's just molded plastic and the rifle is going to go in it. Same thing with wood stocks. They're never going to make the wood exactly the right dimensions to hold the receiver perfect. You're going to be relying quite a bit on the, you know, the torque on the action screws to hold it in the stock, and it might even just slide into place under recoil for the first few shots when you shoot it. But to get the most accuracy, to get a perfect mating platform, you can do what's called glass bedding. They take a fiberglass epoxy. And if you have a gunsmith do it, they'll take your stock and they'll actually dremel out quite a bit of the stock. They'll remove a lot of the material where it normally touches your rifle. And they fill it with this, you know, liquid epoxy fiberglass material. And then they will tape off and mask off the parts of your receiver and barrel they don't want it to stick to. And then they'll squish the action down into the stock with all this epoxy in there. And then let it dry, come back the next morning, and then they'll take it out. And they'll have a perfectly shaped mold in that stock that now mates perfectly to your rifle because the material they removed from the stock and now filled with this epoxy is now all one unit. And you have a perfect glove fit. Well, I've had that done to some of my rifles that it's so tight, it's very difficult to get the rifle out of the stock because it's such a tight fit. You have to sit there and barely wiggle it and pull and pull and pull and pull. It's almost like suction fit into the stock. It's such a tight fit. And you have to be very careful because you can crack this glass bedding. It's just fiberglass. And I'm always so concerned that if you torque it wrong when you're out in the field and you crack it, now you're literally going to have your action and barrel flopping in your stock. It's going to be useless. That's why the military uses the aluminum bedding blocks, because we used to have to jump our rifles out of planes and land on the ground with them like, you know, a sack of potatoes. and you needed something strong that could withstand that abuse. And the only way to do that is with this aluminum bedding block, which is where they take, instead of just being one material of the stock, there's actually a carriage, a frame, a support, something of aluminum that is really what's holding the rifle. And then the stock is kind of molded or attached around that aluminum. So what you're mating the rifle to on the inside is this big chunk of aluminum that's been machined, not a perfect fit. Often they machine them like in a V shape. So the round receiver, when it gets tightened into the bedding block, at least centers itself the same every time. So aluminum bedding block, I think, is a lot more consistent. If you have a good stock and a good rifle, you should be able to shoot a nice pretty group, take it out of the stock, put it back in, and shoot in the exact same spot again because it recentered. But you can't do that necessarily with cheaper stocks.
Okay. Hmm. Perfect. Perfect, perfect. So this one is a bit more of, I think, an advanced topic for some folks, but still consideration on rifle selection. David kind of wrote in talking about the pros and cons of different bolt action types, specifically the categories of controlled round feed versus push feed, and kind of wondering pros and cons there. Are there real advantages to the controlled round feed that some, especially on the mountain rifle side, some guys tend
this
to...
This is a forum debater right here.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, it's a warning advanced topic, meaning is it really worth arguing about?
No, but not advanced topic at thoughts. All. It's yeah. definitely worth arguing about because okay. I'm not afraid to make your readers upset.
Bring it.
this is one of those forum topics where whenever I'm tempted to read something like this or chime in, the answer I'm most likely to type, and thankfully I don't, is get off the forum and go shoot. Like, stop arguing about these things. Spend less time on the forum and more time shooting, more time hunting. Sure. Theoretically, the controlled round feed, so what they're talking about for people that are listening is the idea that a round is still being presented into the action from the magazine. So there's certain cycles of function every rifle or every firearm, almost every firearm goes through. And the first step in that cycle of function is feeding, meaning it's stripping it from the magazine and getting it ready to present into the chamber. Well, on a bolt action rifle, they can be an internal magazine where it's actually inside the stock or an external magazine that's detachable. But as the bolt goes forward and it's pushing the round forward in the magazine from the feed lips and it pops free from the feed lips, on a non-controlled feed rifle, the most popular being the Remington 700, I could hold the rifle upside down. And as I pushed the round forward and it popped out of the magazine, and if I didn't keep good pressure or if I let the bolt slip back a little bit, the round could fall out of the receiver onto the ground. On a controlled feed action, as the bolt is pushing the round forward, before the round even snaps free from the magazine feed lips, it starts sliding up and behind a big extractor on the bolt face. So like the old Mauser style actions that had that big claw sticking on the side of the bolt. That's what that did. As you pushed it forward, it would hold it. So if I held the rifle upside down and did that, it would be pinched on the bolt by the extractor. It would control the feed the entire time, where Remington is called a push feed because it's literally just pushing the round out and getting it in the chamber. It's not holding it as it pushes in the chamber. So the theory goes something like, well, if you're hunting dangerous game, you better have a controlled feed action, because if you don't and somehow the bear knocks you on a somersault while you're trying to shoot, the round might fall out and you could be dead. So you better get a controlled feed gun. I've never had that experience. I mean, there are amazing great controlled feed rifles and there's amazing great push feed rifles. The Remington 700 as a platform that has been copied or is the basis for so many other types of actions or rifles isn't by accident. I mean, this isn't like no one's ever thought of this before. So that's why I mean, theoretically, it's a good idea. But never once in the thousands and thousands of rounds I've shot have I ever had a round even close to fall out of a receiver in action, no matter what angle I was shooting a rifle. It just doesn't happen. In fact, I like the push feed more because I'm a big believer in running a bolt action rifle like I run any other gun. I don't just sit there with an empty gun. I like to keep the gun topped off like I would do with a pistol the second it runs empty. With a bolt action rifle, I mean a push feed rifle, I can throw the round into the receiver with my hand. I don't have to line it up perfectly. I can just toss the round in the ejection port and slam the bolt home. And no matter the orientation of the round, it gets shoved right into the chamber. Where a controlled feed action, you typically have to take the time to load the round into the magazine first and then close the bolt home. So I think I can make the same argument that a push feed might be better because you could get the gun up and running quicker. So it's, I mean, personal preference. Stop freaking out about it. Whatever rifle you have is fine.
Yeah. And once the round's chambered, it's chambered. So in terms of a push feed versus controlled round feed, any claims of accuracy or anything like that, I mean, there's really no factor.
No, not at all. Yeah, it doesn't exist. Yeah, so the only issue, the only difference is in how it feeds, controlled feed or push feed.
Okay.
Once it gets in even halfway into the chamber, you're now into the second cycle of function, which is chambering. You're done with feeding now.
Right.
So it's only when it's leaving the magazine and popping free to get up into the chamber. So if that's a concern for you, get a controlled feed.
Yeah.
I just personally like push feeds. I think I can run them faster. I like how they feel better. The Remington style extractor, with that little curly cube pigtail extractor, is a weak point on the rifle. I've very, very rarely seen them fail, but it is a weak point. So for some people that like different style extractors, like a more of a claw style extractor, sure, those can be better, especially if I'm shooting a dangerous game rifle. That might be a consideration I'm going to have. But this goes back to the minutia of, if it bothers you, worry about it and get whichever one you want. Don't waste a breath arguing with anybody else. If you think controlled feed is necessary, then by all means, go get one.
Mm-hmm.
But after you've got it, now go practice shooting from the kneeling position and get good in hunting positions. Get good at calling wind. Get good at the environmental effects. And stop worrying about that, because that's the rifle you've got. And if you're good, you should be able to make whatever rifles in your hands perform.
I'm hearing a theme, Ryan.
What's that? Start practicing?
Yeah. Stop worrying about all the minutia and make the best of what you have. Seems like a theme. Let's wrap up with this, and I know we could spend some time on this, but would just love to get your thoughts. You know, we're in the midst of preseason. Guys will be out getting their rifles set up in the summer, maybe shooting in the dead of summer and some warm temps. And for some of these guys, they're getting a rifle ready for a late season hunt. And the temperature in which they're sighting in now could be drastically different than the temperature and the conditions that they will be hunting in 4 to 6 months. Clearly, there can be effects of temperature on that, not even to get into elevation and all kinds of other factors, but give us your general thoughts on what a hunter should be looking for, any specific things they should be thinking through if they're setting up a rifle in June, July, August, but not hunting till November, December in the high country, for example.
This one's the most dense question so far, so we'll just skim the surface a little bit.
Let's do it.
The environmental effects have a serious effect on a bullet. Now, not for its necessary accuracy, but from a change in the environmental effects, right? So shooting in high humidity or high temperature doesn't make you better or worse, but changing from a high to a low will have a meaningful impact on what you're actually shooting. So to dumb it down as much as I can, or I shouldn't say it that way, oversimplify it, it all comes down to the density of the air, which is how thick the air is for a certain space, okay? Because the bullet's going to leave the gun the same every time. It's going to leave the barrel. Then once it leaves the barrel, it's on its own all the way to the target. And how fast it gets to the target is everything. Excuse me. It is not to be misunderstood that a faster bullet's better. It's not what I'm saying. But the only two things that affect a bullet on its way to the target are gravity and wind. Unless you shoot a tree branch, then the tree branch affects it. So gravity and wind are really the only two things affecting the bullet. The temperature is not affecting the bullet. What's happening is a change in temperature will change the density or thickness of the air, which will make the bullet either get to the target faster or it'll make it take longer to get the target. And if the bullet takes longer to get to the target because it's slowing down more because it's got thicker air, it's going to fall more because it's been exposed to gravity longer. So a fast bullet doesn't resist gravity because of some sort of horizontal momentum or inertia. No, it's just a bullet is going to fall a certain distance in 2 seconds. It's going to fall more of a distance in 3 seconds. So if it takes 3 seconds to get there, it's going to fall 3 seconds worth of distance. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at these environmental factors, it's not 20 variables that affect the bullet. It's two, wind and gravity. Faster we get there, the less wind affects it, the less gravity affects it. Now, don't think that means more accurate is people will have this never-ending race to get the fastest bullet possible. Not the case. I'm just talking about changes from when you zeroed it like you asked to when you actually go hunting. So when if you focus only on the thickness of the air, then all the other variables, I think, make more sense. So colder air is more dense than hotter air. So it's thicker. So the colder it gets, the lower your bullet's going to hit at distance because the air is thicker. Okay, so it's going to slow the bullet down more. It's going to have more time to fall. It's also going to hit lower because your powder is going to burn slower. So in a colder cartridge, the colder powder in the cartridge actually burns slower than a hotter cartridge. That's why if you shot in a fairly rapid fire string, each bullet will get progressively faster and faster because it's being preheated by the warm chamber while it's sitting in your rifle. So the ambient air temperature getting hotter will not only make you hit higher because of the faster bullet because the powder burned faster, but also because the air is less dense, so the bullet can fly through the air easier. So you go up in elevation, you zero your rifle where I grew up in Phoenix, and you go up to Flagstaff at 7,000 feet to go elk hunting. That's a huge difference in elevation. It's also about 25 degrees cooler. You're going to have thicker air, so the bullet's going to slow down more. But you also went up in elevation, which means now you have thinner air. So you have thicker air because it's colder, but then it's thinner air because you're higher altitude. So they can actually kind of balance each other out, those two variables. And then you have humidity to worry about. And higher humidity has the opposite effect you would think. Higher humidity is actually less dense air. Go figure that one out.
Yeah. Certainly doesn't feel that way in the dead of summer when it's humid out.
Right. But for the air to hold the moisture, it has to be less dense. So higher humidity, higher elevation, higher temperatures, bullet's going to strike higher because it's thinner. Lower humidity, lower temperature, lower elevation, the air is thicker. So the bullet's going to hit lower. That's how I like to remember it.
Okay.
Now, how much yours is going to do, I'm not. There's no way we can get into that. Yeah. The bullet shape, the ballistic coefficient, the velocity, the specific amount of change you had, that's all going to change. The best thing you can do is shoot in a couple different environments, take some notes on what happens. This is the one of the rare times I recommend using a ballistic calculator. You know, go. There's free ones online. Go find good data that you've got now, record the environment you were in, go find a ballistic calculator, and play with the elevation, play with the temperature, and see what's going to happen. And if you got a chance the day before your hunt, drive a few miles down the road and take a safe shot and see what's going on.
Do you think the ballistic calculators that allow you to input the elevation and the temperature and things of that nature, which I've seen and played with a little bit, do you think those are reasonably accurate, at least enough to give you a good idea of what might be happening?
Yes, they will give you a reasonable idea of what might be happening or should be happening.
Okay.
But almost never have I seen someone pull out a ballistic calculator and have it be dead on.
Right.
There's just too many variables. So everyone that swears that I'm wrong will stand there embarrassed in front of me while they're, oh, I had this input wrong, or I didn't calculate. I had station pressure versus barometric pressure. Oh, let me change that variable. So they always tweak and tweak and tweak until they finally get it. But it's definitely going to give you a good idea what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, right now, you're 270. I don't shoot 270. I don't even know if I've ever pulled the trigger on a 270. I'm serious. So if you asked me, Ryan, I was in San Antonio when I zeroed it, and now I'm going to go to Denver and I'm going to go hunting, exactly how many more inches high or low is my bullet going to hit at 300 yards? I would have no clue. I would go straight to a ballistic calculator.
That's good to know. I mean, even understanding the fundamentals of, you know, higher elevation, higher humidity, you know, higher impact. I mean, that's the
main
concern.
Guys get their elevation wrong based on their angle they're shooting or the environment quite a bit.
Yeah.
It'll be freezing cold. They zeroed their rifle when it was nice and hot, and they're shooting at 300 or 400 yards, and they're shooting at an angle, and they forgot all that because they were so excited to see the animal.
Right. If guys are working up their own loads, are there other particular things they should be considering, or it's all these same variables in terms of working up a load in the summer and wanting to use it, you know, in different conditions in a late season hunt? Is it come down to these same variables, or are there other particular things to consider about load development that come into play?
Good question. Get the most ballistically efficient bullet you can get if you want the environmental effects to mess with you less, right? So if you have a bullet that is has a high ballistic coefficient, so it screams through the air easily, it's not going to be affected as much. If you have a bullet that's, you know, just a round nose lead bullet that's like a fist flying through the air, that's really going to be affected by the density of the air a lot more. So that's one. The other is the powder you get. Some powders are just more sensitive than others to temperature. You know, when someone talks about the velocity they get of their bullet out of their gun with a certain load, it should almost always be included with the temperature, because even a 5 or 10 degree difference will make a noticeable difference in velocity.
Mm-hmm.
So when someone says, oh, I get 2,500 feet a second out of this load, 2,500 feet a second at what, 75 degrees? Because you're not going to get that at 50 degrees. So it really does matter. So if you're going to load for hunting and you want immunity to the environmental conditions, yeah, you want an efficient bullet and you want a stable powder. And the more modern powders that are coming out are amazing. The stuff they're coming up with now for the chemicals and the coatings are very temperature stable.
Hmm.
So I like, for example, for the loaders out there, I buy H4895 by the 8-gallon jug. Okay, because that powder can be used for so many things. I can load it down. I mean, I'll make those 300 Win Mag loads. You can load them down to the power of a 308 with that powder safely. Other powders, you can't. So I get that powder. I know how it works, and I run with it, and I'll make a choice on which caliber I'm going to go for in the future because I like that powder. So that's another trick, is not have 20 different powders in your loading room and 20 different bullets. Pick one. Learn it. You'll be fine.
Hmm. Good stuff.
Awesome.
Steve, do you have anything else to add while we have Ryan here?
No, I was just going to ask the question exactly what my bullet will do at 2,000 feet versus 7,000 feet, but Ryan told me not to. So.
Well, 3 inches low.
3 inches low. There you go. Take his word for it.
Sounds good.
He stayed in Haldane Express last night. 3 inches low.
Yeah.
Seriously, people don't go practice. I don't get that. Guys will figure out what's wrong with their equipment during the hunt.
Yeah.
I'm like, weren't you up there the entire day before drinking beer? You couldn't drive 5 miles down the road, go put up a piece of paper and shoot it and just make sure everything's working right? That's the best way to test. Go get a free example of what happens at that altitude by going and doing it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, especially hopefully, you know, a lot of our audience is packing in good ways, and hopefully either at the trailhead or before they get to the trailhead or wherever they're pulling off, they can find a decent spot before they're hiking in to actually chase some game. I mean, that's even less of an excuse considering they're getting back there to pursue the game.
Right. And again, though, these changes we're talking about, I mean, you're not going to miss the animal because you misjudged the humidity.
Yeah.
You're going to miss the animal because you jerked the trigger.
Yeah.
Right.
Fundamentals. Comes back to the fundamentals. Ryan, we really do appreciate it, man. It's been good. I feel like there's a bunch of other stuff we could have covered. It's amazing that we've chatted probably 3+ hours now on these episodes, and I still feel like there's so much more that we could go, but we appreciate everything you've shared with us for sure.
I appreciate it, guys. I mentioned to you before, your listener support's been great. I had a noticeable bump in book sales. I'll plug it real quick, if you guys don't mind, the Long-Range Shooting Handbook. Yeah, you guys, yeah. It's been 18 months now. It's been out this month. So a year and a half, I can't believe it's gone by. It's been 24,000 copies. You guys have bought the snot out of it, and I appreciate it. And you guys have left good feedback, and you've asked great questions. And I think I get to every email. I try to. I was just telling the guys that I've changed my work schedule as of this week, and I'm just dedicating way more time to writing books. So the advanced version of the book should be coming out by Christmas. That'll be my goal. So you guys have been an amazing support. Your guys' listeners are extremely loyal and ask good questions, so I appreciate it.
Yeah, we certainly appreciate our listeners as well. We appreciate you. I mean, we gave away 10 copies, thanks to you, through the contest, and had over like 1,000 guys enter to try and win those 10 copies, and we gave away 10 copies. Just actually finished wrapping up the last few of those copies and shipping them out with today, right, Steve?
Yep, yeah, I shipped them today.
Yeah, so there you go.
1,000 entries for 10 books?
Yeah.
Wow. So yeah. 990 of you better be buying a book soon.
Buying a book, yeah. That's funny.
Come on, guys. 25% of the book, that's my easiest line, so never ask me for a free book. Like, hey, man, can I snag a book? I'm like, yeah, and I tell them where to buy it. Like, oh, no, I just want one. I hold up my hand. I go, well, 25% goes to military charities, so let me calculate 25% is zero. Make them feel guilty for not buying one.
That's funny. So recap for us, Ryan, where we can check you out on the web and social media and all that stuff.
All right, I appreciate it. Amazon.com, honestly, is the best place to find the book. I sell some of the books myself at RyanKleckner.com if you really want an autographed copy. If you want an insulting autographed copy, for some reason that got popular for a while. So people have been asking in the notes to send an insult. And so I'll put some disparaging remark as I sign the book about your ability to shoot or your reading comprehension. You can get an autographed copy there. But Amazon's the best way to do it, just for, you know, fast shipping or getting a good price on the book. And it helps with the ratings. And I really appreciate it. And you can just keep up to date. You know, sign up for a newsletter or check out the news to see when the advanced version of the book is coming out. You got a couple articles coming out for either Gun Digest or Recoil, or as I'm dedicating more time to writing, these articles are going to come out more, and hopefully I'll be doing more podcasts and stuff like this. So, keep your eyes and ears open, and I really appreciate all the support.
Awesome. Well, Ryan, thanks again. Thanks for joining us. All right. Well, that is a wrap with Ryan. Once again, if you guys are interested in this type of content and you haven't heard it, be sure to go back to previous episodes and check out the Building a Backcountry Rifle series. Not only did we do a couple shows with Ryan, but we really went pretty deep and gave a good overview of building a backcountry rifle. So the rifle selection, projectile selection, optic selection. It was really a fun series to work on, and we're excited to bring some more rifle-related content into this fall. So check that out. As always, you can find all of those episodes, the ways to contact us, and everything else. Just go to exomountaingear.com/podcast. All right, we'll catch you guys next week.